And listen to these words, this vision from Isaiah, sitting before the throne of God.
In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty, and the hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." The pivots on the thresholds shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live core that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. The seraph touched my mouth with it and said, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed and your sin is blotted out." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me."
This day comes from Paul's letter to the church at Rome. This is his magnum opus. This is his incredibly dense theological tome. We've been spending, 4 weeks on chapter 8 and repeating quite a bit of it each time. He's talking some serious stuff here. He's talking about folks who aren't so sure they belong, that they don't count, that they aren't part of God's love. And he writes this to them. "For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received a spirit of adoption. When we cry, 'Abba, Father,' it is that very spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. If in fact we suffer with Christ, that we may also be glorified with Christ. I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies, for in hope we were saved. Now, hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience." So a couple of very dense readings today from Isaiah and from Paul. And two very different ways of looking at our relationship with God. One of awe and one of intimacy. Those can go together. One of my earliest memories from when I was 4 years old was my father's promotion ceremony at the Naval Base in Newport, Rhode Island. He was being promoted from lieutenant to lieutenant commander. I didn't know that at the time. I just remember him looking magnificent, positively glowing in his dress white uniform, his gleaming sword and scabbard at his side, the admiral pinning new epaulettes onto my father's broad shoulders. I didn't understand any of it, but I knew I was in awe. The pomp and the formality and the stiff choreography gave the ceremony a gravitas that was palpable even for a four-year-old boy. Afterwards, everyone was saluting my father, addressing him as Sir and Lieutenant Commander Hay. I don't even know if I could have pronounced Lieutenant Commander Hay when I was 4 years old, but I didn't have to, because I could call him Daddy. Because I belonged to him. Because I belonged. 12 years later, 13 years later, when I was 16 or 17 years old, I kind of hoped I would get a little bit of that authority and gravitas. When I would bring a date, the cheapest date you could do was go on the base. You could go to a movie for 35 cents, play racquetball for a quarter. It was pretty awesome. And the best part was I would borrow my dad's little MG midget, take the top down, girlfriend on the right, come up to the gate, and there's a Marine about 5 years older than me, has to salute, and always looking a little like, saluting this 16-year-old kid. We had one time, I was like, yeah, I'm getting saluted. One time the Marine saluted, glared at me, and looked at my girlfriend and said, I'm saluting the license plate. I'm not saluting your girlfriend or boyfriend. I was like, yeah. But that's the memory that came to me this week as I read these two scriptures, this vision of Isaiah's and this calling from the Apostle Paul. Isaiah gives you the sense of the power and awe and the overwhelming gravitas that must have overwhelmed someone who has a vision of coming before the author of the universe. And his first reaction is, woe is me. And yet Paul assures us that this God who sends galaxies spinning across the night sky like a child blows dandelion leaves across the backyard, this God beyond time and space and human imagination comes to us as Abba, Daddy, Mommy. Because we belong. You can call this infinitely mighty God Abba because you belong to God. You belong. You are beloved. That is bedrock gospel reality. You belong, and nothing can take that away. Just to let you know, to make sure, Paul says, what can separate us from the love of God? He asks rhetorically, the answer being no, nothing, nada. But he can't just leave it there. He goes, I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Jesus Christ our Lord. Period. You belong. And nothing can take that away. Paul uses this lovely metaphor to show us at a visceral level how it is that we belong. He uses the term adoption. We who had or have or had parents of flesh and blood, parents who may have been able to show us deep caring and grace and unconditional love, and those who were not able to show us that, regardless of the quality of our human parentage, we're promised that we've been adopted into the very heart of the God who John describes as love itself. Paul writes, for you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received a spirit of adoption. When we cry, Abba, Daddy, it is that very spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. We belong, and nothing can take that away. Over the years, as a pastor, I've met a number of adults who are products of the foster home system. Some of the stories were okay. And some of the stories of these foster kids are shocking. At their worst, these kids dealt with debilitating abuse, awful and unloving relationships, dismissive attitudes, and perhaps worst of all, they grew up with an existential uncertainty. Will this be the day my foster parents get angry enough to send me back? To show me once again, to confirm to me once again that I am worthless and unlovable, a burden, a monster, an outsider. I've also met some amazing foster parents. Our former next-door neighbors on Woodlawn Drive worked so hard for years to get custody of their foster child, whose birth parents could not be a steady, loving presence because of their substance abuse problems. But oh, when the day came and the celebration, when the adoption was finalized, it was real. It was palpable. It could not be reversed. And they could finally tell their now adopted son, you belong. And nothing can take that away. Nothing can take you away. Now, why does Paul use a term like adoption? Scholars are all over the place on it, but one stream of thought is Paul uses that term because many of his readers in the Church of Rome were Roman Gentile Christians, former pagans who feel excluded from the God of Paul, the God of Jesus, the God of Abraham and Sarah, the God of Isaac and Rebecca, the God of Jacob and Rachel, because they're not part of the heritage. Their DNA does not point back to Israel. They may not be circumcised. They may not keep kosher. They may not do any of the things that say, I'm part of the tribe. One gets hints that the church was that he was writing to had a Christian pecking order. Maybe you've belonged to a church like that. You had the best kind of Christians on top. A ranking of who was the truest or the realest or the most privileged kind of Christian. And over the years, different churches have used different stuff. Christians who spoke in tongues or could interpret tongues were better Christians than those whose spiritual gift was, say, hospitality. In Roman culture, it was wealthy and free Christians who felt they were more beloved and rewarded by God than the poor and the enslaved Christians. Christians with a Jewish background may have thought that their long history of relationship with God, the God of Israel, gave them a leg up on Christians who, up until recently, were worshiping dead pagan idols of gold and marble. Well, Paul says to that whole system, no. You are all, every one of you, adopted children of God. You are all beloved, and no one is more beloved than another. Each one is infinitely more beloved than a human heart can fathom or absorb. You're swimming in an ocean of grace. You don't have to say that you're a better swimmer than another. You belong, and nothing can take that away. So they assign this reading every third Trinity Sunday. Trinity Sunday. Oi! Not even going to bother trying to explain the concept. I think Patrick did a fine job there a little bit ago. I don't want to explain the concept, but I want to share the repercussions of it. Here's the thing about God as Trinity, as Father, Son, Holy Spirit, Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer, all one, is that relationship is built into the very essence of our triune God, a divinity, a well of being itself that is somehow three, somehow one. Now again, on Trinity Sunday, pastors are tripping over themselves trying to use a metaphor, an analogy, a word picture to try to explain it. We got shamrocks, we got water, we got even tiny squeeze cans of three-in-one oil. I've always thought that was lame. But all of them fail miserably, of course, because human words cannot contain it. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer. Augustine, I love Augustine's way of describing the lover, the beloved, and love itself. There's a fancy Greek word. I've shared it with y'all, I think, every year on Trinity Sunday. Perichoresis. Perichoresis. And it's a mutual indwelling of love that invites us to be part of that mutual indwelling, that mutual abiding, us abiding in God, dwelling in God as God dwells in us. Father Richard Rohr, who I think is Benedictine, no, he's Franciscan, uses the metaphor of a circle dance, noting the similarities of the Greek word for mutual dwelling with dance, perichoresis. I understand the word there, it doesn't actually connect to choreography, but it's still a great metaphor. Richard Rohr says, perichoresis asks each of us, are you ready to take your place in this wondrous dance? Are you ready to take your place at this wondrous table? Can you imagine that you are already part of the dance, even if you don't know it yet? You belong, and nothing can take that away. What is it to be part of the dance? To acknowledge your adoption as children of God. I can tell you what it's not. Being part of the dance is not to be self-satisfied and superior, knowing that you have a golden ticket to heaven. It does not mean that you can be smugly superior. It does not mean that you should go on TV and demand power and privilege, because newsflash, God has made everyone a child of God. God is especially fond of you, and God's especially fond of the person next to you, and God is especially fond of the person you really don't like down the street, and God is especially fond of the undocumented alien and of the anonymous person living across the globe, and all of y'all, you belong. And nothing can take that away. Paul reminds us that recognizing we are a child of God means we recognize that it is a calling, not a privilege, a divine calling. Paul says to the believers in Rome that they are all called to be ambassadors of reconciliation. That might need some nice epaulettes also, don't you think? Ambassadors of reconciliation. Jesus gave us marching orders. Go and be my disciples. Go and make disciples. Now, here's the thing that we get confused about as Christians. He didn't say go and make converts. He didn't say to go make people who can recite a set of religious and dogma points. He said, go and make disciples, people who are learning to live and love like Jesus, people who, by the way you live and love, might come to trust and know the love of God that we meet in Jesus, the God and we, that God that Jesus and we can call Abba, the one who gently says to us, I love you, you are mine, you belong to me, and nothing can take that away. It is hard to remember in a hard and harsh world that we are beloved and we're called to let others know that. So we have to do the work of love with revolutionary patience, a term coined by feminist theologian and poet Dörte Zola. Susan Rakosi, a biographer of Zola's, notes a deep and recurring theme of Zola's was the question, is theology even possible after Auschwitz? Bigger thing, is it possible to do theology in a world where radical evil is rampant? How do we speak of the presence of God and the love of God in a hurting and broken world? Well, Paul says, here's how we do it. We do it by mutually indwelling in God's love, partnering with God in reconciling and repairing a broken world. I've told you the Jewish term for that, the Hebrew term for that, tikkun, repairing the world, repairing the breach. It's not a call to escape into religious rule-making or spiritual navel-gazing. Zola speaks of a mysticism of wide-open eyes. I like that. A mysticism of wide-open eyes. It's not closing your eyes to the world and going la, 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 la. It's getting out there and getting involved in it. You make mistakes? Absolutely. You fall down? Yes. That's why there's grace. That's why there's forgiveness. We have eyes that are open to the world in God. A mysticism that involves prayer and protests. Meditation and marches. Worship and work. But knowing it takes time. And also knowing that it's not all up to you and me. We indwell love, and love indwells in us, and we let it happen. There's a conservative Christian blogger who's decidedly not a feminist theologian, but I really loved her words. I don't know if she knew she was borrowing from Zola, but she used the word revolutionary patience in a blog of hers. And it was very powerful. She writes, in a life so full of instant gratification, we are unaccustomed to waiting. We are unaccustomed to allowing God to tend to our hearts while truth slowly filters in. For time to show us the lesson deeply embedded in the trial. We struggle to find an answer, any answer, so we can understand, but sometimes there is no understanding, there just is. And so we must choose hope. That's the term Paul uses, as well as patience. Because hope, she writes, is revolutionary patience. It begins in the darkest places, the times we feel utterly lost and alone, where confusion reigns. And instead of shrinking down into a spiral of self-doubt and discouragement, we speak truth to the lies that come for our peace. There we find the strength to stand, cradled in a stubborn hope that believes that if we show up, if we do the right thing, dawn will come. The light will break into the horizon. The warmth will show its truth, and it will penetrate our soul and will fill us with peace. It will teach us to be patient. It will show us that we do not face this world alone and that we are better for the heartache. That will not fit on a Hallmark card. And Paul echoes this sentiment. I guess really she's echoing Paul's sentiment when he writes, now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience, revolutionary patience. Brothers and sisters, this Trinity Sunday, may you come to know the revolutionary patience that comes with knowing that you belong to God. This Trinity Sunday, may you have the quiet assurance that you dwell in God and God dwells in you, just as Christ dwells in God and Christ dwells in you. This Trinity Sunday, may you hear God invite you, invite each of us to the dance, the divine dance of love, doing the work of reconciliation with an assurance that there is no more loneliness for you. There is no more loneliness because you belong and nothing can take that away.